Buy with Rob is your best choice when purchasing your new home in the Puget Sound area. Call 360-710-9425 today and get started on the best home buying experience you will ever have. Go to buywithrob.com today.
Sharks evolved from gray wolves. That's why they have such a great sense of smell. And it's also why a shark will never attack a wolf. Now, contrary to popular belief, sharks cannot breathe fire because they did not evolve from dragons. Or did they? No, they didn't. They didn't at all. The great white shark was at one time called the pretty good white shark until 1973 when they really upped their game. And of course, the hammerhead shark was instrumental in winning the American Revolutionary War. General George Washington himself trained hammerhead sharks to ram and capsize British cargo shipping.
Sure about that?
Huh?
I don't know if that timeline works.
Oh, there's that timeline.
Well, that's what you sound like. That's what you sound like.
Hello?
Podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Bowman?
Approach and identify.
Hello?
Oh my God!
From the Pac Northwest studio of the Podcast 99 Network, located in beautiful downtown Silverdale, Washington, this is Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show podcast. Now, here's your host, the submarine qualified, well-coffeed, rules-driven, elitist history buff, Dave Bowman.
Weapons calling, you have permission to fire.
You have permission to fire, con weapons out.
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today, most of them far beyond our control, you might say. So perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, politics, and the news. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. Well, they finally found it. The smoking gun on Brett Kavanaugh. He said something back in 1999 that proves he's unfit. Does. Really. We mean it this time. $200 million of your money is headed to the Ukraine. Yes, that Ukraine. And the holiest week of the year is upon us. It had kind of a start. Some good, some bad. We'll talk about it. Because we do. Here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. That's 565-3283. The email is dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and whatever web browser you use. Just Google The Dave Bowman Show. Hey, lo qui conizio, the greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. I have no idea what's going on here. Like 5 seconds before I went on the air, a whole bunch of stuff just disappeared. And I don't know where it went. So I'm frustrated by that. But anyway, we'll get through it and we'll make it happen. Happy Monday, everybody. Glad you're with us today as we start yet another week of Plausibly Live, the Dave Bowman Show, right here in the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Hope you had a good weekend. It is going to be warm here. I can't say it's going to be hot anymore because so much of the rest of the country is really hot while we are, you know, tickling that 90 level. But the big difference between here and everywhere else I've ever lived is we don't have air conditioning here. So I think I saw a report this morning that less than a third of homes in the Puget Sound area have air conditioning, and we don't. We don't really need it. I mean, even on a 90 degree house, so it's not unbearable. But at the same time, it is a little warm. Kind of gotten used to those 60s and 50s. I'm not ready for the hundreds and 90s, and we're going to California next month on vacation. We're headed down south and see the folks down in Tehachapi and all that. And I'm just not looking for it. I keep trying to tell Cam, you know, half the state's on fire and the other half is in the the 100, the triple digits. Do we really want to do this? Can't we go to, I don't know, Canada or something instead? But no, we got to go see my parents. I say that like it's a bad thing. It's not. We're going to have fun. But anyway, we're doing the 101 route. We've never done that before. I've talked for years about wanting to drive the 101, and we never have. We always get in a hurry every time we're going somewhere which way or the other. And so this time we're going to do that because we have the time. And so we're going to do the 101 and see all the cool stuff there is to see. So over the weekend, if you were paying any attention to the news at all, and I was trying not to, but you know how it goes. Brett Kavanaugh, the Trump nominee to the Supreme Court of the United States, released information at the request of Congress. He sent a bunch of writings and rulings and answers to questions to Congress, amongst which happened to come a 1999 roundtable discussion at which he explained that he wasn't sure that Nixon versus, or I'm sorry, got to get these right, because there's two different cases here. The case we're talking about today is U.S. v. Nixon. Nixon v. U.S. is a completely different case, and in fact, a completely different Nixon. So I got to keep, if for whatever reason I get them mixed up today, please understand that the context of today's discussion is U.S. v. Nixon, 1973, not Nixon v. U.S. Not only a completely different case, but a completely different Nixon, although it did involve impeachment. So there you go. He intimated, Judge Kavanaugh intimated, that he wasn't certain that the 1973 landmark decision by the Supreme Court, an 8-0 ruling, that President Nixon must turn over subpoenaed documents to the special prosecutor. He thought maybe it was decided, let me use his word, wrongly. And this, of course, caused a tizzy amongst people that are, both wonkish and following the entirety of the story of the Supreme Court nomination of Justice Kavanaugh. Judge Kavanaugh, he's not justice yet, sorry. The truth of the matter is that I presume he's going to be approved with no nuclear option, and no real methodology to slow the nomination or stop the nomination. It's basically a de facto done deal. It's just everything right now is pro forma, and everything now is let's follow the Kabuki theater dance until, and so he'll answer these questions, and then we'll have a hearing at which he won't answer the Democrats' questions, and Republicans and Democrats will point fingers at each other, and nothing of actual any substance will be discussed. It'll all be about abortion. It'll all be about Roe v. Wade. It'll all be about Mueller. And now it will be about this 1999 roundtable, at which Judge Kavanaugh stated that he wasn't sure that U.S. v. Nixon hadn't been decided wrongly. Now, this is causing a great deal of heartburn. It's causing a great deal of finger pointing. How dare this guy think? I mean, this is the smoking gun that proves that if Mueller's case ends up in front of the Supreme Court, that he'll vote. He's already telegraphing that he'll vote for Mueller for Trump against Mueller. And so we won't get a good investigation, which, of course, all presupposes that there's actually something to investigate in the first place, which is becoming less and less clear as far as certainty goes. Now, I know that Democrats' heads just exploded, but let's face facts. Trey Gowdy said something over the weekend that I thought was actually pretty accurate. The release of the stroke text, in which he said that there's no there, has caused a good deal of what are we investigating? And Trey Gowdy's comment that there isn't anything here. If there was, Adam Schiff would have leaked it already. Rings true. This is something that I've believed for a long time. This goes back to the moon landing stuff from 19, whenever that was. The moon landing stuff, we're supposed to believe that 400,000 people involved with landing on the moon could keep their mouths shut about a conspiracy to fake it. The same is true here. We're supposed to believe that all of these government employees, all of these government staffers could keep their mouth shut. And experience tells us better. Experience tells us otherwise. Experience tells us that there's no way that they could or we even would do that. There's way too much, I don't want to call it investigatory reporting because it's really not. There's way too much opportunity to make a name for yourself by being the leaker. So it tends to not happen. That's kind of my belief of the whole thing. It's not, there's nothing here. If there was, it would have been leaked already. And so we wait. So here we have this discussion by the judge. What does he mean? It was wrongly decided, U.S. v. Nixon. Now, U.S. v. Nixon, for those of you who aren't old enough to remember, came out of the Watergate investigation. 1973, 1974, we had the Watergate break-in, we had the cover-up. What did the president know? When did the president know it? And in an odd circumstance, in an odd thing that was not really foreseen by the framers, somehow or another, the Department of Justice ends up under the executive. Well, the president then hires, quote unquote, assigns, asks for a special prosecutor to investigate whether or not the president was involved in all of this. And of course, this created a constitutional brouhaha back in the day and still does today. I mean, there's still arguing about it today as to whether or not this is the best way to do this or not. Well, unfortunately, because of Congress assigning too much power to the executive and assigning things to the executive, how else do you make this all mesh together? And of course, no one was willing to presume that the president himself would be involved in any nefarious doings inside the White House. I don't know why they didn't presume that, but I wasn't there and they thought differently than I do, and probably you do. Nixon, as it turns out, not only was involved with the Watergate break-in, but he was seriously involved with the cover-up of the break-in, and the de facto proof of this was found on some tapes that he made through a secret taping system in the White House Oval Office, where he would tape conversations. Now, to some degree, those tapes have provided us with some very interesting history. There's one of those tapes that's one of my favorites, where he actually has a solution to the North Vietnamese problem. He's ready to drive the North Vietnamese out of the war. And at one point on these tapes actually advocates using nuclear weapons against the North Vietnamese. And it's Henry Kissinger who says, it might be a bit much. We don't really need to go that far. And if you listen to it over and over again, it's not really a joke. I mean, you don't look at it and go, ha, he's serious. Kissinger talks him out of it. So to some degree, these tapes are actually useful and valuable. And of course, LBJ taped his phone calls, and it's not unusual for presidents to tape conversations. I'll tell you something that I do on occasion. When I'm taping interviews, I run the tape before and after. Now, I make sure I tell them that I'm doing so, because usually there's some point of discussion or something in there that I need, and it helps jog my memory rather than having to take notes right down there. I don't tape everyday phone calls, but you know, there's really no need to. So at the end of the day, these tapes existed, and the existence of those tapes became public during one of the hearings, and the whole thing blew up at that point. What did the president know? When did he know it? And Nixon began to stonewall. He began to claim executive privilege and refusing to turn over these tapes because he felt that it was none of their business. I mean, executive privilege, the Constitution says the president can't be pursued while in office. He had some arguments that may or may not have held water. The problem becomes this. It really is simple. It's if executive privilege exists, and I think we all agree that it does, how far does it go? And to the point in 1973 of U.S. v. Nixon, no one had determined how far executive privilege went. The idea that the president could refuse to turn over documents, refuse to turn over information to investigators, to Congress, to anyone else has created arguments throughout our history. In fact, it's what got me thrown out of the Tea Party some years ago when people were furious that Obama wasn't turning over information that they wanted, and he was under the concept of executive privilege, he was refusing to do so. Well, the Constitution does allow for that. Our laws do allow for that. Do we want to change the laws on that? Do we want to change the Constitution on that? And by the way, the things with Obama had nothing to do with a criminal investigation, which is really where Nixon, U.S. v. Nixon, went. Does executive privilege extend into the area of criminal wrongdoing by the President of the United States? Just Judge Kavanaugh's comments in 1999 are being portrayed in the light that of the general belief that he is a Trump pick, so that if the Mueller investigation makes it to the Supreme Court, he will side with Trump, and that'll be the end of the Mueller investigation. His comment that U.S. v. Nixon was wrongly ruled is being portrayed as the smoking gun evidence. By the way, the smoking gun is a reference back to Watergate, but those of you old enough to get it will, the rest of you will not. It's being portrayed as that smoking gun that this is proof that Kavanaugh is just a Trump plant to keep this from happening. But is that necessarily the case? Did he necessarily mean that it was an incorrect ruling, or that it was ruled right for the wrong reasons? You see what I'm driving at here? There's a difference between the two, isn't it? There's a reasonable argument that Brown versus Board of Education was the correct ruling, but the logic behind it is somewhat twisted and bizarre. There's the Obamacare ruling, where Justice Roberts decided that a fine was a tax, even though the lawyers arguing for it specifically said that it was not. And yet somehow or another, his logic behind it was strained. And in fact, in U.S. v. Nixon, even though it's an 8-0 ruling, there was a lot of behind the scenes arguing amongst the justices. One of them had to recuse himself because he had been part of the Nixon administration. There was a lot of internal debate into the Supreme Court as to why it should be an 8-0 decision that the president's executive privilege does not extend to criminal activity, and he must turn over these tapes. The president, then Nixon, tried to mollify the whole thing by releasing redacted transcripts of the tapes, but the problem with that is, you know, it's not really going to solve anything, because it's words on a paper. You don't get tone. You don't get context. You don't get those kinds of things. And there was still the matter of the existence of these tapes. Were the tapes even legal was part of the question in all of this. At any rate, the court internally was just torn by this, and the Chief Justice wanted to write his reasonings, but none of the other justices agreed with his reasoning as to why. They all agreed that the president should have to turn it over. But the problem is if we limit executive privilege now, today in 1973, what happens in 2019? What happens when the circumstances aren't exactly the same, but the arguments become the same? You follow the drift here. It really created a great deal of difficulty and a great deal of strife internal to the Supreme Court. Even though they had made essentially, I don't know that I would necessarily characterize it this way, but even though they had made essentially a political decision that the president was going to have to turn over this, the long-term consequences of that ruling weighed heavily upon all of them. How do we rationalize this so that it makes sense downstream? Even then, they were realizing that people that were in the White House weren't necessarily always going to be men of good character, men of good faith to the Constitution. And let's face it, where is that line where executive privilege begins and ends with regards to anything that a president might be accused of? And this would come up again under Clinton. It came up again under his articles of impeachment. How far does executive privilege go? It came up again under Obama. It's come up under every president you can name. In essence, since 1973, it's been a political argument since then. Prior to that, it was kind of an academic argument. But then again, prior to that, there really wasn't any need for it. It was a very rare occurrence that someone would say, I'm going to invoke executive privilege. You don't need to know that. Additional problems rise in when you start dealing with national security. And in our world today, how hard is it to stamp something national security and immediately make it not subject to whatever? So this decision then was made 8-0, as I said. And Judge Kavanaugh remarked that he thought it was decided wrongly. Heresy, though it is to say that, he actually said. Does that mean that he felt that Nixon, is that actually an indicator that he believes that executive privilege should extend so far that in the event that Trump v. Mueller or Mueller v. Trump or whatever ends up in the Supreme Court, that a Justice Kavanaugh could be depended on to cast his vote towards Trump? Is a done deal? Is that what that actually indicates? Or is there something more to what he was saying? Of course, it's a roundtable in 1999. How many years ago is that? 09, nearly 20 years ago. So Josh Hader, pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers, tweets something in high school that's racist and homophobic. And today he gets to undergo sensitivity training offered by the Major League Baseball people because obviously he's a racist. But at the same time, here's Judge Kavanaugh making comments that are at an academic roundtable that actually, in many ways, raise some legitimate questions. Was it decided correctly? Not in the sense of was the ruling right or wrong, but was the process by which the court made its decision correct? And if so, then does it have the minimum amount of impact on future cases is what he's driving at. But of course, it's not being reported as that. It's being reported as, you know, he thinks Nixon was innocent, which of course is not what he said, nor is it what he meant. Anytime you're dealing with lawyers, and you should know this, anytime you're dealing with lawyers, getting a straight answer out of them on anything, even what time is it right now, is problematic. It depends is almost how every lawyer starts a sentence. Kind of depends on this. It's possibly that. It, you know, we got to look at all the circumstances. We have to take everything into account. And why would a judge be any different from that? And of course, if you're looking to have an actual discussion and you're talking about U.S. v. Nixon, you're not really going to have much of a discussion if the moderator says, so was it correct or not? And everybody says, sure, it was right. Okay, so all these people that paid $15-$20 for a ticket to come to this event, this roundtable discussion, can go home now because we've decided after 30 seconds of discussion that this was correct. It's possible that Judge Kavanaugh was simply not playing devil's advocate, but simply playing lawyer, simply saying, well, what about this condition? What about that condition? What if? These are the issues. What if this is going on? What if that is going on? So when you see in the news over the next few days, and it may get buried by this Iran thing, so I wouldn't necessarily get too excited or too sure that anything's going to happen because Iran and Trump are yelling at each other now. When you see those headlines and when you hear those questions, if you watch the judiciary hearings, and some of you I know will, you can understand that that's going to be the question. Was U.S. v. Nixon decided correctly is going to be the question. And then you're going to see a tap dance like you've never seen before, which is, look, maybe it was decided incorrectly, but it was the right ruling. I said this back when Heller was decided. It was the right ruling. It was the wrong reasoning. But in the world we live in, which is all about incorporation, well, it had to happen sooner or later. The problem is it doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily in keeping with the spirit of the original ideas of the Bill of Rights. So anyway, we'll get to that. There are problems with Judge Kavanaugh. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I am a Judge Kavanaugh fan, because I'm not. I think that there are serious issues with Judge Kavanaugh's positions, particularly when it comes to national security issues, when it comes to Bill of Rights issues. He's made it clear that he believes that national security trumps the Bill of Rights. He's made that clear. I have issues with that. I believe that Justice Kennedy would have had issues with that and did. There are certainly plenty of things that we can argue about with Judge Kavanaugh that will make a lot of people uncomfortable. Is he a better pick than somebody else would have made? Probably. Is he the perfect Supreme Court judge? Can't say that he is. Can't say that if I was playing Supreme Court fantasy Supreme Court, he would have been my first pick. I can't say that. But I'm not the president of the United States either. And unfortunately, the president of the United States is going to have to deal with the idea that there's going to be a great attack, especially after this 1999 roundtable was released by Judge Kavanaugh himself, to the effect of the fact that, well, maybe Nixon was decided wrongly. And that is the smoking gun. That's it. That's the answer. That he would, that he's just there to decide Mueller versus Trump, which would actually be US v. Trump, but we'll cross that bridge when we get there. I don't know. Judge Kavanaugh certainly is a fine man. I mean, there's no two ways about that. He certainly represents the best of a lot of things. Is he the best pick for the Supreme Court? I don't think so. But then I'm a libertarian. And Justice Kennedy, the man that he's replacing, was a libertarian. And Judge Kavanaugh strikes me more as a Republican rather than a libertarian. Makes me uncomfortable. What do you think? Area code 209-565-DAVE is the text machine. 565-3283. Email remains Dave at the DaveBowmanShow.com, which I do actually read now. And, sorry, something on the television is distracting me. And, of course, we're on the web. Just go to the DaveBowmanShow.com or Facebook and Twitter. Got to take a little break. We'll be back right after this.
This is the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You are listening to The Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
This is one of the most common sharks in the Bahamas. It's actually mating season right now for these animals. Males actually have two reproductive organs. They're called claspers.
Hold on a second. Are you telling me this shark has two penises?
That's right, Rob.
Yeah. It can mate from either side.
I love sharks!
What's not to love? Welcome back. Plausibly Live, it is the Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Area code 209-565-DAVE is the text machine, 565-3283. Email remains Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for thedavebowmanshow.com, Facebook, Twitter, iTunes. So Shark Week got underway last night. And I realize that for most people on conservative talk radio, Shark Week is, you know, why talk about that when you can talk about people yelling at each other? Let's see, the Iranians yelled at us, so Trump yelled back at them, and everybody's having a meltdown. Oh my God, he's a warmonger. Did you read what Rouhani said to start with? I mean, who's the real warmonger here? Anyway, putting that aside, because there are more important things in the world. Shark Week got a new 30th anniversary of Shark Week. Look, I'm a Shark Week aficionado. You know this. You know how I feel about sharks. And this is something that weighs deeply in my soul. Enough that I had legislators on my show when I was on terrestrial radio to talk about their bills to stop shark finning. Even, and you talk about pulling teeth. You want to know what's wrong with our political system? I got a Democrat legislature who's scared to come on my show because I want to talk about shark finning, and he's afraid that I'm going to attack him about something else. And it took a good week to get him to come on the show to talk about shark finning. I've also had congresspeople. I've actually had a congressman. I won't mention his name, but it rhymes with Dennis Cardozo, who refused to come on the show unless I was given a set series of questions. You will answer these questions. You will ask these questions. And if you deviate from that, I will terminate the interview. Naturally. Anyway, be that as it may, Shark Week is a pretty important thing to me. And that's it transcends politics. It transcends everything else because I love sharks. I find sharks to be fascinating in so many ways. Not only are they ancient, you know, I mean, sharks have been around for, 500-600 million years. I mean, think about that as a species, to be around that long, how well adapted and evolved you have to actually be. All the changes that this world has gone through in 500 million years. Think about that for just a minute. I mean, we think of the dinosaurs, you know, disappearing. What was that, 65 million years ago? That's a blink compared to the 500 million that sharks have been around. And yeah, we've gone from the megalodons down to the great whites and so forth and so on. But as a species, to survive that long speaks well of the species, does it not? They're fascinating creatures. They're beautiful things. They just to me, they've always been very impressive and very interesting. They fascinate me. They really do. And I think the only thing that fascinates me more is the fact that orcas have apparently declared war on great white sharks. And in recent years, orcas have taken to attacking great whites, slicing out their livers and leaving the rest of the carcass. Maybe we need a law to ban that. Who knows? So Shark Week is something that I look forward to annually. I look forward to it as an important television viewing element of my life. There's not a lot of television that I watch, mostly baseball. Some Smithsonian Channel. I watch my morning news show, which is slowly starting to grate on me. It's just too perky. It's just too, everything is very upbeat. Hey, did you know that only one third of Seattle households have air conditioning? Isn't that great? Think what we're doing for the environment. Anyway, point being that Shark Week is something that I actually tape, I actually record, and I will watch over and over again. Eventually, the DVDs or the release will come out, and I'll have it on Netflix or whatever, and so I won't have to do that then. But so it was with great anticipation that I sat down last night, and because I have DirecTV, I'm able to watch the East Coast feed of this. I don't have to stay up till freaking midnight to watch it, so I'm able to watch the East Coast feed of this, and it's like the first episode is Bear Grylls, Bear versus Shark. Now, I guess in concept, this is a good idea. You have Bear Grylls, the known outdoorsman who eats everything, taking on sharks that might eat him. Disappointingly, I don't mean to be a spoiler alert here, but they don't eat him. I know, shocker there, huh? It starts with him jumping out of a helicopter with nothing but a fish in his hands. He lands in the water in the middle of a school of sharks, and then he excitedly and with great aplomb somehow manages to get into scuba gear, which I assume was on the bottom. I didn't pay that close of attention to it. And then he swims to the reef, which he climbs out on the reef, having swam through the school of sharks in Bear Grylls attitude and action with the exciting music under it. And then he climbs out on the reef and explains to you that if you managed to survive that and you came to this reef, you would die because you wouldn't know how to spearfish the way I know how to spearfish. Because I know that if you don't spearfish right, the sharks will get you. See, so more divers are attacked shark fishing than spear fishing than anything else. And then he goes to spearfish, and I got to tell you, 30 minutes into this, I was bored out of my mind. Bear Grylls does not. The problem with Bear Grylls is that it's all fake, and I know that. I know that know that he's not. Anyway, it was boring. It was just Bear Grylls telling you what a great guy he is because he's swimming with sharks and spearfishing around sharks and living on a reef around sharks. And God, before you know it, he's going to be a shark. And I thought, oh, this is going to be a disaster. This is going to be the biggest disaster of Shark Week since Megalodon, which was a great show until you realize about halfway through it that it's completely fake. And that's when Shark Week went totally faux docudrama. It went, you know, mockumentary. And I thought so mad that year. And I think that was 2014 because Kevin and I were on the air. I was so disappointed that Megalodon wasn't real. Anyway, so it was shaping up to be that kind of Shark Week. And I'm like, oh, my God. And it wasn't going to get any better because the next one was Shaquille O'Neal versus Shark. So the idea here is we're going to take the biggest man in the world, Shaquille O'Neal. We're going to put him in a cage and put him in the water around sharks. But Shaq apparently has some sort of phobia about sharks, and he doesn't like them. And so they have to teach him to get ready, get used to the sharks, get him in the water with some sharks, some smaller sharks, and touching sharks, and to get ready to go out with the actual, I think it was Mako's. I don't remember. He's going out in the deep ocean, and they're going to put him in a cage that they had to specially build, the Shaq cage, because he's so big, and they're going to put him in the water and let him dance in front of sharks. And I'm not kidding about that. And I thought this is going to be even worse, except that they had that one hosted by Rob Riggleman, who is hysterical to me. I find Rob Riggleman very funny. I don't know why, I just do. Ever since he stars as the president of the Navy in NTSF. He's always been one of those guys that I just find funny, and he turns this, of course, into a fiasco with Shaq, and it actually worked out pretty well, I thought. His whole spiel about the hammerhead sharks were personally trained by General Washington to attack British ships during the Revolutionary War had me relieved. Shark Week might actually survive this, might actually be good this time around. Unfortunately, neither Shaq nor Rickleman got eaten. So, but they do take him out. They get him acclimated, I guess. They take him out in the water and they put him in a cage, Shaq cage. It's the world's largest shark cage because Shaquille O'Neal is a big guy. Big, big guy. In fact, his feet, they had to make special flippers for him because his feet are as big as the regular regulation size flippers. So anyway, they finally get him all out there and he's in the Shaq cage, which is then lower, you know, in the water. And what nobody has realized is because everything has been upscaled so much, the windows that you normally look through to see the set windows, they're not really windows, they're holes that give you a clear view out to the sharks, are bigger than usual. And of course, one of the sharks, not a very big one, probably a 3, maybe 4 footer, swims into the hole and gets in the cage with Shaq. And of course, this causes... I never seen a big man move that so fast in the water. And everybody's panicked because, you know, I'm pretty sure the insurance bonding agents are having a conniption fit because what happens if Shaquille O'Neal gets eaten by a shark or bit by a shark? It would have been great television. Don't get me wrong. It would be awesome. But I'm pretty sure the insurance companies were upset about that. Anyway, they get him up and they get the shark out of the cage. And then Shaq asks the diver, the master diver, well, how did he get in there? The diver looks at him and goes, through the hole. How do you think he got in there? Anyway, they put him back down there and he starts dancing around with the shark and rapping with the sharks. And it's, you know, it's pretty typical corny Shark Week crap, but at least it was funny. And then they bring in Ronda Rousey. And this is tough for me because I have absolutely no interest in MMA fighting at all. None. I understand the appeal to it to some people, but it just does not appeal to me at all. I'm sorry. I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying I don't see what's so great about it. I really don't. I used to love boxing. I loved boxing in my youth. I was a huge fan of the middleweights and stuff like that. I used to love that stuff. And then Boom Boom Mancini, who was my all-time favorite fighter, accidentally killed a guy. And it sort of went, this just isn't the sport for me anymore. I'm just not, I lost interest in it. I have no interest in MMA at all. But Ronda Rousey, I guess, is a, what do they call her, Hall of Fame MMA fighter with no diving experience at all. And they're going to put her in the water with bull sharks with a guy. They put her in the water with bull sharks with a guy who had his arm and leg bitten off by bull sharks. Ooh, this is tense, right? And then they're going to take her out in the deep water and put her out there with Makos and have her feed a Mako shark by hand and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the point is that for 58 minutes, you're wondering if Ronda Rousey's going to be eaten by a shark. And of course, she's not. So you just wasted, you know, 58 minutes of your life waiting to see if this woman in a bikini is going to get eaten by a shark. And she doesn't. I have some great ideas for how they could liven this up a little bit. But unfortunately, they would probably cause some major insurance problems. And nobody's going to allow that. I don't know. I just don't think it's good television to put bait in the water. I mean, that's what they're doing, right? I don't really care how you describe it. Bear Grylls, Shaquille O'Neal, Ronda Rousey, they're just bait. The only reason they're putting them in the water is because there's this, it's the NASCAR effect. The only reason people watch NASCAR is because they're hoping to see a wreck. And you know, you're secretly hoping that one of these people will get bitten at least, and it never happens. But the tantalizing possibility keeps me glued to the screen. It's like the people who watched Finding Bigfoot. Finding Bigfoot, the show, ended this year. 7 years. 7 seasons that thing's been on the air. And they canceled it this year. I'm assuming it's because they didn't find Bigfoot. At any rate, we watch this stuff and we hope for it. Now, tonight, I've looked over the schedule. Tonight is a little less of the celebrity stuff. There is some celebrity stuff. You know, Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, and somebody else, they're going to go out there and tag sharks. This is scientifically, this is actually pretty important to tag sharks, but they're going to put these celebrities out there and let them try to tag sharks. And as it turns out, sharks don't like to be tagged. It annoys them. So again, there's the tantalizing possibility that Aaron Rodgers could be eaten, which for those of us who are not Green Bay Packer fans would be okay. But for the rest of you up there in Wisconsin, where the real Americans live, I can see where that would be an issue. Well, you know, he's not going to get eaten because if he would, they wouldn't show it. And number two, the Packers wouldn't have let him do this if there was any actual danger. Get too much invested in him. So that's on tonight. But then they actually get into shark documentaries. They've got one where they're going to Cuba. The researchers have finally been allowed into Cuban waters, so they're going to do that. And there's one about a great white. And these are actual documentaries that I enjoy. I do love shark documentaries. I really do. So that's your Shark Week review and preview for Monday, the holiest week of the year. I love Shark Week. I love sharks. I do sharks all year round. But in the meantime, what are you going to do? And I know. But at the same time, it fascinates me. And that's what this is really all about. What fascinates Dave? Doesn't fascinate you, you know, get your own show. Talk about what matters to you. Meanwhile, the great debate continues over whether or not the president is Putin's lapdog or not. I don't know why it's that much of a debate, but apparently it is. $200 million in our money is going to Ukraine. Yes, that Ukraine, the Ukraine that used to own Crimea, which traditionally belongs to Russia, and Russia invaded a few years ago under some president, I don't remember his name, and we basically said, don't do that. And now we're sending $200 million in military aid to Ukraine, because that's what you do when you're sucking up to Putin, I guess. It's very confusing and it's very irritating, but at the same time, it speaks back to the fact that when did we talk about this? When did we discuss this? When did we decide as a people that Ukraine is worth going to war over with the Russians over? Did we really decide that? Have we really sat down and gone, yeah, it's worth it? Yeah, we're ready to go to war with Russia because Ukraine. I have no personal feelings one way or the other towards Ukraine. I mean, I've never been there. I only know two people that are from there. And of those two people, I kind of get the impression from at least one of them that they don't even care about it at this point because they've left there. Is it really worth going to war over? And when you start sending $200 million worth of aid to people, what are you really saying here? Are you really saying, yeah, I'm your lapdog? Or are you saying, well, we're going to stop you here. We're going to do this because it annoys you. We're going to do this because why? I just, there's a great deal of, I'm not sure what the word for it is. There is a great deal of dichotomy here in the ideas that you either believe that Trump is Putin's lapdog or you believe that he's not or whatever. And of course it says more about your politics and you than it does about what's actually going on. But in the meantime, we are sending $200 million worth of equipment and money to Ukraine to help them forestall, at least, Vladimir Putin's expansionist ideas, which would seem to fly in the face of that whole logical argument. But we're doing it, again, under the guise of national security with no discussion, no debate, no input from Congress, none of that. Simply an executive decision made by the executive department, whether it was Trump himself or the Pentagon himself, is a little unclear at this point by my reading. But somehow or another, we're supposed to go, yeah, we're fine with that. No debate, no discussion, no argument, nothing. All we're saying is, well, here's a few hundred million dollars worth of equipment and have at it. I've said this from day one, and I will continue to say it, and it's something I will probably take to my grave. I do not have a problem with the concept of a long war. I don't, functionally, I have no, a war doesn't end when one side says it's over. See, we said combat operations in Afghanistan are ended, and we're still having people getting killed. We had one get killed last week in Afghanistan in a combat operation. Wars don't end when one side says it's over. They end when both sides agree that it's over, one way or the other, whether that's an unconditional surrender, whether it's a, you know, armistice, whatever. Both sides have to agree to this, and both sides have not agreed to this. And so us saying that it's over is kind of like, I don't know, kind of like putting Bear Grylls in the shark-infested waters and saying, will he be eaten? Well, of course not. It's not over. I don't have a conceptual problem with a long war if we know why we're doing it, where we're going with it, and what the actual aims and goals of it are. But what are they? What are we actually trying to accomplish here? What is the military strategic objective of this ongoing conflict that has now engulfed how many countries where we now have troops that we don't even know about? Because national security, we just send troops into, what is it, 54 or 57 African countries? We got armed predator drones flying in Mali now. Mali. How many of you could even find Mali on a map? How many Americans could? Do you recall this discussion in the Congress? Do you recall Congress debating whether or not we needed to go to war in Mali? Afghanistan? Yeah, we did have sort of a debate about that, but we didn't have a declaration of war. We had an authorization for use of military force. We have a president deciding these things that can happen, and this is actually going back to Judge Kavanaugh. This is one of the things that he actually speaks well of. He has a problem with the fact that executive power, the ability to take the United States to war without congressional opinion, might be a problem. So the same guy who said Nixon might have been decided wrongly, not meaning it was the wrong reason, wrong decision, but the wrong reasoning, has also said, hey, we might want to think about that. We might want to consider whether or not that's legit or not. But in the meantime, we're sending $200 million more to Ukraine, which is bound to annoy Putin, which is bound to result in more people saying, well, how dare he use bold American diplomacy? How dare he talk to people? Look, he's yelling at Rouhani over in Iran. This man's a madman. And in the meantime, we don't know what's going on. And the truth of the matter is, we don't care. Because we haven't held our congresspeople accountable. Our congresspeople don't care. Our congresspeople are just cheerleaders for whatever party they happen to belong to. They're not interested in actually serving anybody. They're interested in actually making money and being reelected and becoming millionaires. Constitution, that's about 50th down on their list. And until we get a hold of that, we're going to spend a whole lot more money in other directions that it ought not be going for reasons that we don't know about. And it's easy to get upset, and it's easy to get riled up, and it's easy to get fired up about it all. But until we all do, and until we all start holding people accountable, from the president down, it's going to be more of the same. Meanwhile, there's sharks off Cuba, so I'll watch that tonight and whatever else is going on, and try to be ready tomorrow for another episode of Plausibly Live right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Meantime, I gotta get running. I got a lot to do today. I promised Ben I'd take him to the Y, so we're gonna go swimming in this heat. And he's got his he's been asking for these for a year now, and I finally got him some goggles. I don't think they do any good, but he's convinced that they will. So we're gonna take him swimming and let him do that. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You would miss them if they weren't there. So don't pass up those opportunities. You don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I'm Dave Bowman, and this is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. Make sure you check us out at podcast99.org. You got This Week in U.S. Politics with Jay. You got Tim Preuss. You got me. You got the Hail Evangelist. You got all that stuff right there. All of it can be found very simply, very easily at podcast99.org. Have a wonderful rest of your Monday, everybody, and we will see you tomorrow for a Tuesday episode of The Dave Bowman Show. Meantime, stay cool as you can. I know it's hard, but drink a lot of water, stay hydrated, and stay cool. See you tomorrow, everybody. Have a great day.
Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.